The following program was recorded on April 14, 2011, by the Radio Television Program at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second annual Archie MacDonald Speaker Series at Stephen F. Austin State University. I am Ryan Murphy, Dean of the College of Liberal and Applied Arts. This speaker series promotes the legacy of Dr. Archie MacDonald. His lifetime of work has enriched our understanding of American culture. But more specifically, Dr. MacDonald has become the voice of this region. He has told the world that East Texas matters, that it is special. So it's not so much that SFA is honoring Dr. Archie MacDonald with this series. It is that Dr. Archie MacDonald is allowing us to associate ourselves with his legacy. A great university needs a great speaker series, and now we have it. Tonight, we will be introduced to a man who has shaped our culture by example and by heroism, Mr. Alan Bean. The question we should be asking ourselves after tonight is over is, do we have the right stuff to make a difference? Now it is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Andy Teal, who is president of SFA Student Government Association. This event would not have been possible without the support, the work, and the inspiration of our Student Government Association. It is the students who have made this event possible. And as Andy comes out, I would like everyone to give a round of applause in recognition of our students.
Good evening. I would like to thank everyone for coming out tonight. Student Government Association and the College of Liberal and Applied Arts have been working very hard on this event to make it possible. I would also like to thank Mr. Alan Bean for taking time out of his busy schedule to come share his story with us. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce a man whose leadership at this university has left a legacy for future generations as well. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage President of Stephen F. Austin State University, Dr. Baker Petillo.
Tonight, I have the privilege to introduce SFA VIP, Mr. Brad Maul. Mr. Brad Maul graduated with honors from SFA in 1957. He had a degree in English and theater. He left SFA and went to Los Angeles, where he spent the next 30 years as an actor. He played many roles during those 30 years, but he is best known for playing Dr. Tony Jones in ABC's General Hospital. He's also been nominated for an Emmy Award for Best Actor. He's been nominated for an Emmy Award for Best Supporting Actor. But after 30 years, he left Los Angeles, returned to Nacogdoches, and at the current time, he is serving as a lecturer at the university and teaching in our cinematography department. At this time, Mr. Brad Maul.
Thank you very much. I have to read this because it's so important to me. I'm a huge fan. So every great civilization has heroes. Explorers who went ahead of the rest of the people to bring back knowledge of what was on the other side, to find out the unknown. Many crossed lands and oceans, but only a select few have made the journey into space, and even less have walked on the surface of the moon. Tonight, we're fortunate to have one of those heroes. Alan Bean was born in Wheeler, Texas. In November 1969, Captain Bean landed on the moon after a flight of 250,000 miles. He was the fourth man on the moon. He went on to command Skylab 3 for a record-shattering 59-day, 24,400,000 mile journey. And perhaps most importantly, at least to those of us who can only dream of space, Alan Bean brought back his impressions of those journeys and turned them into great, wonderful paintings. He has visited worlds and seen sights no artist eye, past or present, has ever viewed firsthand. So, artist, astronaut, Texan, I'm proud to present Captain Bean.
Well, Alan, I think you've just conquered another world here.
It's a very friendly world.
It's a good world, too. Let me take a moment of personal privilege as we begin to thank each one of you for attending this evening and being a part of our conversation. Thanks also to Brian Murphy for conceiving this lecture series and for some reason or another, associating my name with it. I guess hanging around for about 5 decades has consequences one never suspects at the beginning. And we're all indebted this evening to Dean Adam Peck and to Andy Teal and the Student Government Association for the many resources, including especially the financial resources. So we're all their guests this evening, and we thank them for letting us be here. And I am most appreciative to you, Alan, for the life you've lived, the very actualization of the observance that we honor here, one who has shaped our culture as we've come to be and who will shape it as we go on to what we will be for the remainder of the century itself. So let's get started on our conversation then this evening. And let me begin by saying something that you wrote yourself that kind of sets the stage for our visit to the moon. You wrote, "We'd come a long, long way and soon come to the rest on a rocky, dusty surface of the moon. I knew only 2 human beings, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, had walked on the moon. Soon Pete," meaning Pete Conrad, "would become the 3rd, and then it would be my turn." So we've got some images here that you and I are going to go through about getting to that step. And please comment between them as we go through. We're going to start off, I believe, just seeing our perspective, where we are in this galaxy that we inhabit together. You have a comment about that?
Well, of course, that's an artist rendering, and we're just a small or a medium-sized star, the sun, in this great galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And when you look at all those stars out there, that many of them have planets around them, you see how small maybe we are. But at the same time, as far as I know, as far as anyone knows, I believe, we're the only people, the only entities that can go where we dream, that can move among those stars. Those stars are trapped in orbits. Planets are trapped in orbits. They can't go anywhere. We can. We are a special entity in this universe as far as we know right now.
The human element still mounts.
We're small. They're huge. Yeah, but we still can do things that they can't do. Each of us can. Each of us is different.
I like that because it just kind of gives me the perspective. I've never been able to get my mind around the concept of infinity. And at least that picture has borders, and I can deal with that, I think, a little bit. Let's go on to the launch pad then. And you're sitting there in that giant candle that's about to go off. What's in your mind?
Well, what was on my mind, and usually in an astronaut's mind, is not fear, other than wanting to perform like you've been trained. We were trained so well, and the whole purpose of training is to make you skilled in what is going to happen normally, and if things don't happen normally, something goes wrong, like Apollo 13, the flight after ours, then you know what to do. So we're setting up there. I can remember thinking, I hope if something happens, I know what to do. That was on my mind.
And as we go on here now, we're going to see a picture of the blast off as you're beginning to leave, and the world is rumbling, and things are happening. It turned out that it turned out to be a lightning strike, but you didn't know, and no one on board knew exactly what that was at the time. You just had to go on with what you were doing. I heard you discourse on that a little bit one time. You said you hoped you didn't do the wrong thing.
No, it didn't. Here we are going off. The rocket was rumbling and shaking much more than I had imagined from all the training I had, much more than any vehicle or aircraft I'd ever been in. If we hadn't been strapped in very tightly, we would have been thrashed around up there, and our visors would have hit the instrument panel, maybe broken a switch or two or broken our visor. So we were tied in there. The 6 million pounds of the vehicle and then the 7.5 million pounds of thrust is tremendous energy that humans have created to get us to the moon. Russians couldn't do that. Just Americans were able to do that so far. But we were struck by lightning, and I can remember we got struck. We didn't know it was lightning at the time. The effect we had in the spacecraft was about 25 warning lights came on, and the electrical system went away. And like I said, my dream was that I would know what to do when something went wrong. And here we weren't even a minute into the flight, And I had no idea what to do. So Pete Conrad, who was the greatest astronaut I ever knew when I was an astronaut there for 18 years, he had told us before the flight, he says, we've trained hard. He said, but there's going to be one or two things that happen during this flight that we've never trained for. We don't expect, engineers didn't anticipate. Lo and behold, it hadn't been a minute into the flight, and we had one of those. Thank goodness the designers of the spacecraft, Mission Control, gave us some advice, and we were able to get things back to normal almost by the time we got into orbit. So it was a big surprise, but
you handled
human
it. Yeah.
American engineering helped us.
You know, I heard one time that one of the great advantages that we had during World War II over the Germans is that when something went wrong, our people had a little bit of ingenuity to figure out what to do next, whereas their opponents were still waiting to be told what to do next. And so that's sort of the same thing.
I think it is, and I think that's one of the characteristics that is true of Americans. Yeah. And it's true of the students here, and they have to be able to find ways to use that ingenuity in their line of work and make their contribution.
I agree. Now let's go on into space here a little bit, and we're going to kind of look back, and we're going to see the Earth behind us. What do you think about when you're looking back at that?
Well, I can remember looking at it when it was about that size, and I could see North America down there, and Baja California, and maybe down through Mexico, and I can remember up in the upper right-hand corner, you can see the ice cap, because we went in November, so the North Pole was large and a lot of ice there. And I can remember thinking, is it possible that everybody I've ever seen on television, that everyone that I know is on this Earth is down on that little ball? And then I thought, maybe there isn't a reason they wouldn't fall off the bottom. You know, it's funny, you've seen the pictures of it, and I had many times from Apollo 8, and 10 and 11. But it just didn't seem possible that we could all be on that beautiful blue and white ball. But there everyone was. And we were, incidentally, it didn't look like we were leaving. It looked like we were still and the Earth was leaving.
Okay.
And I knew that we had to get back there in 10 days. And I thought, we can't do that on our own computers. Mission Control has got to figure this out. One thing about spaceflight, it requires a lot more teamwork than flying airplanes, for example. And I thought, if we can't communicate with them and they can tell us where to make the burns, their big computers in Houston, we're not going to get back to that planet. Yeah. So it was nice to know that the people that worked on the spacecraft knew that and made the spacecraft work
for us. And they were thinking for you, too.
Thank goodness.
A little bit ahead of you.
People cared. That's why I think Apollo worked so well. I had a number of people come up to me before and after saying, I make the bolt that does this. I'll tell you, if this fight doesn't work, it won't be that bolt, or it won't be that radio.
Yeah.
It won't be that switch. Everybody cared.
Well, that kind of pride is precious to you because you're depending on that.
That's right. We need to all have that about whatever we do.
I agree.
Not just
that.
Space flight. Right. This is just one thing that humans
pride
do.
Pride in ourselves. To
That's
do the
right.
Best
we
thing.
Do the right thing.
Well, let's go on up now. We're going to get, next images are your paintings, your memory and your experience, and you're running along there.
Oh, I am. I was having fun. On Earth, I weighed 150 pounds. My suit and backpack on Earth weighed another 150. So on Earth, I weighed 300 pounds. I sure didn't run whenever I was wearing the suit in training. But up there, suddenly I weigh 1/6 of that. So I weigh 50 pounds, less than I do even without the suit. I can remember feeling so strong. I mean, if I thought about it, I knew it was the gravity. But when I wasn't thinking about it, I could just reach over and pick up something. Even my arms weighed 1/6. So it was like it was the best day I ever had. I felt like I could run the marathon there, never really get tired. But I'll tell you this. That's a great spacesuit. It's really a spaceship. It's just built a little different. It's just like the shuttle. It's got to have an environmental control system to keep you just right temperature. Mm-hmm. That did it. Got to have a communication system just like the shuttle. Same thing there. But it doesn't have a rocket engine. It's got your two legs. So I can remember thinking, I can't turn my ankle. When I would run along the moon, It wasn't like running on the beach where I could just look at the sunrise or something like that. I had to keep looking down to make sure I didn't step in a crater. And I sure wouldn't want to step too close to that crater behind me there, because that's about a 3.5 billion year old crater, and no one has any idea how close you could get to it before it gave way and slipped down into the crater. If it had, if I'd gotten that close and it had, I'd be up there today. We wouldn't be having this conversation. So there's a lot of things to be careful, but it was so much fun. I believe that one of the future things that will occur in spaceflight is tourism, because everyone is going to, not everyone, but most people are going to want to go there, and they want to experience this. They won't have to wear spacesuits. We'll have some big domes bigger than this room, and you can just have your clothes on. And if you want to play basketball, there'll be one with the hoops about 3 times higher, because you can jump up and slam dunk. So it's going to be a fun thing. Someday they'll have the Olympics on the moon.
Coach Casper would like to have somebody that could dunk at 30 feet, I guarantee
he
you.
He would.
You know, it's one I was just thinking as you were talking about that. It's almost like you could say that you took the Earth's environment with you, the oxygen you breathed, the food you ate, and so forth, you brought with you, and waste back, and so forth. We visited the moon, we've been in space, but we're still Earth people.
We are, and we're going to have to do that. Human beings are wonderful. We're great. As I say, they're most special entities in the whole universe that we know of right now. Probably some others out there. We just, in my opinion, haven't run into any of them. So we're special. But we need an environment. We need a temperature. We need to breathe. We need pressure. We need to be able to talk, to work with each other, things like that. So we need things, but we're very adaptable. I can remember when I first got to the moon and tried to stand up. I couldn't. I had to grab onto the limb again and hold on the ladder. And then I would let go, and after another few seconds, I started to wobble again, much like a kid does. You know how when children are little and they're trying to learn to stand up, and they'll hold on to the couch, and then they'll let go, and you'll see them start to wobble, and finally they sit down on their diaper. Well, I had a diaper on too, so I didn't sit down on it, but I grabbed on. But that's the way I felt. And then pretty soon, in 3 or 4 minutes, I'd adapted. I could do this then. Humans are wonderful. I've learned a lot of things in the 18 years I was there. Teams of people, teams of humans are better than they ever imagine, better than the teams imagine. Individual, there's no one in this audience today, including you and me, that know what we could do if we would concentrate on doing it for every day for 3 or 4 or 5 years. We would be so qualified in whatever that is. These students need to realize if they give their best effort, they can do so much with their life.
And cooperation is a key.
Yes.
Let's go on now. Let's get another scene of the moon here, because I think we're going to see you and Pete Conrad here with your probe there.
That's a core tube. And it's an elementary thing where you wonder what's below the surface of the moon. So it was a hollow pipe. And I used the hammer and drove it down into the moon about 2 meters, about that far, and then pulled it out and put a cap on it. We brought it back to Earth. Now, that's not much, but that's the way it all starts. That's what we'll do when we go to Mars someday. When they go back to the moon, they'll take a drill and go deeper. And then on Earth, we've got drills that go down, 2 or 3 miles?
Yes.
And someday they'll go all the way down to the core. This is how you find out what the history of these bodies are, where we came from, where we're going.
And what it's made of strata of it,
Not only that, when you bring this material up, you can see if there was a magnetic field maybe 1 billion years ago. You can see what our sun was like 2 billion years ago, which we can't tell here anymore. Maybe that'll help us understand where we are, what we're going through, all these things. By the way, I love that painting because it's Pete and I working together, which we did a lot up there. We worked with Mission Control, and it's called Helping Hands. It's one of my favorite titles, and that's what you have to do. To make these things work, you've got to learn to work with other people.
And I think the next one, we're going to see a little fantasy here, aren't we? We're going to see something that never... Oh, we got there too fast.
Here we are.
Well, I guess we missed fantasy, so we're going to come back out of space here. This is the parachutes that are slowing down that vehicle that's bringing you back at 17,000 miles an hour or something like that.
That's right.
It would burn up without the heat shields. And this is you and Pete and Dick Gordon coming back to...
I'm looking out the window. This camera was in my window. And I can remember when those chutes came out thinking, wow, thank goodness those things came out.
Really
we would have hit
work.
The Pacific Ocean pretty hard. Yeah. So they came out, and they're reefed now. They're not fully blossomed because if you blossomed them, they might pull off or too many G's.
Okay.
So they come out in that reef condition. Then after a while, and you're stabilized and slowed down, and then they blossom out to the big parachutes, and then you land on the water. Landing on the water reminded me of when I was in college or high school, and somebody would run up and maybe on the football field or out playing out and hit me in the back. Didn't hurt, but it kind of gave you a hit.
Mm.
And that's what it felt like when
I thought
we hit the
all
ocean.
Of a sudden.
Yeah, it was okay.
Well, let's see the last one in this series in, and now you're on the water and you're being rescued. And these are not paintings. This is a photograph, and I believe that's you just about to get out of the lifeboat.
Right. I'm just getting in. You can see my bare feet there. I can remember looking out the window after this 10-day and seeing the ocean move, and I thought it was amazing. I said, "Wow, look at this. This is moving." And then I looked at the clouds and said, "They're moving too." And I thought, "What is the big deal? I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and I'm enthusiastic about this." And then I thought, for the 10 days that we were gone, I never saw anything move but the three of us and our two spaceships. Nothing moves on the moon. Nothing has ever changed on the moon ever since Galileo Galilei looked at it long ago with an elementary telescope. And that's what most of the universe is like, except for us. We get to live our whole life on this planet. It's got color. It's got motion. It's got rain. It's got wind. I'll tell you the effect it had on me. I've never complained about the weather since I've been back on this earth. I've never complained once about the traffic. I'm just glad people are there. I'm glad cards are there. I don't complain about standing in line at the post office. I'm glad there are humans around. When you go to a planet that's huge and the only two people there are you and Dick Pete Conrad in this case, you're glad to be back. I'm glad to be here in Nacogdoches. I'm glad, believe me, it's better looking out here than looking out on the lunar surface with no one else there. I'm glad I went, but this is better.
Well, it's always good to have company.
Oh, it is.
Now, let's go back to space here for a little bit. I understand that when you selected your foods and things that you're going to eat, and you all had those choices, that you selected spaghetti. I know you could have had 78 other things if you had just asked for it. And besides that, I understand it wasn't all that good. So why spaghetti?
Well, when I was in college, I didn't have a lot of money like many of your students. And I worked. And there was a Italian restaurant about a mile and a half. I didn't have a car either. I walked. Mm-hmm. But about twice a week, I'd go over there because you could get all the spaghetti you could eat for a dollar. And also rye bread with butter. And I can remember going over there and looking forward to that twice a week. And I began to love spaghetti, which became my favorite food. It is even today. And so I said, I want to get this spaghetti. I want to be the first human to eat spaghetti on the moon. And I was worried that Neil or Buzz would eat it.
Yeah.
But it tasted so bad. It didn't taste like any you've had, believe me. So they didn't. And I had them pat me the spaghetti and some Tang, you know, and some peaches that were good, dried peaches, you put water in them, that was good. But I had them pack another meal that I said, I'm not going to eat it, but I'm going to bring it home. And right in my studio in Houston on the wall is this, the spoon I had on the moon, and the spaghetti dried up, and the Tang and the other. And I think about it from time to time and think, you know, that was fun. I'm glad to remember this food wasn't that great, but it was the first guy to ever do it on the moon.
At least you can never take that record away
from
you. No,
you can't.
Absolutely.
It's fun. You've got to be yourself in life. It's hard to be yourself, I've discovered. People have a role that they want you to play, and the minute you start doing some of these things that you think are fun, not all of them think so. It's a constant struggle to be the person you want to be.
Be true to yourself is the
main
thing.
That's right.
It's
hard. It's hard.
Well, now let's talk about how you got into space. Come back to Earth just for a little bit. You have observed elsewhere that hard work, just working hard and applying yourself, was the most important thing you learned in the schools, and also helped to get you to space. What do you mean really by the hard luck, hard work?
I don't know. I think it's probably from my parents, but I felt like that you were naturally a certain smartness. I felt in high school that I was maybe a B or C student. You know, I mean, that was just sort of like I was that tall and had gray, you know, not gray hair then, brown hair or something. Mm-hmm. That's just who I was. And I went off to college that way. And so I was making B's and C's. And I began to realize that if I wanted to become a pilot and if I wanted to compete, because the world is competitive, the best people get selected to do these different things. I began to realize, I thought, you know, that guy over there, or that girl over there, they're making A's. I palled around with them. They're not smarter, any smarter than I am, but they're studying. And I began to start studying. When I began to study, I know this sounds crazy to many people, particularly at this school. When I began to study, I began to make A's. It wasn't like I was a B and C person. Yeah. I was a B and C person because I wasn't studying. And so I began to say, you know, I can do anything maybe, or do a lot of things if I'm willing to work.
Yeah.
I began to start working, and I began to make good grades. And I began to say, look, I need to do this. And that's what I do now every day. Before I came here this morning, I painted this morning. Because that's my profession now. Painted for an hour, got in my car, drove up here. I'm driving up. I get up at 4:45 every morning, work out, have breakfast, start working. I've never been the best at anything I've ever done in my life. I've never been the best pilot in the squadron, never been the best astronaut, any of that stuff. But I kept going, working at it day after day after day. Everybody claims they do. Thank God most don't. So if humans are willing to persevere, mm-hmm. you can have the life of your dreams because it's competitive and you can win just by showing up every day and working hard. Right. So I'm a believer in that. I'm a believer
in that sort
of thing.
That's a good lesson for us all to learn.
It is.
And along the way, something you also discovered that was useful to you is that you read self-help books.
I read a lot of them, and I found I didn't read them until I was after college. But I began to realize there were people around me that seemed to know more than I did about how to react to other people, how to be good team members. And I began to read about it and realize that there's a lot of information in the world, for example, that my parents didn't know, or my sister didn't teach me, or my uncle didn't know. But that person over there knows how to be a better teammate. And that woman over there knows better. And they write these books, and you can read them, and you can learn to be a better human being. I read them now. I've read her book recently. The most recent one has to do with how to work with people when you have conflict, how to present something. One of the lines in there I remembered, if you've got a good idea, you can take that good idea and present it as a bullet, or you can present it to their head as a seed. I'd hate to say that a lot of my time at NASA, my good ideas were presented to my boss as a bullet, but I shouldn't have done that. But this book pointed out that, look, if you plant the seed, you got a better shot at it. I never knew that. I know it's many people in the audience, it's elementary. It wasn't elementary to me.
So you put those two things together, hard work and learning from others how to proceed, and teamwork all along.
All that.
And you've got a pretty good formula there for some success.
It worked for me. I've never been, like I told you, never been the smartest guy, never been the best guy, but I've had the best life of any of these others, period. I'm the luckiest guy in East Texas, no doubt about it. And it's not with my gifts. It was being willing to do these things.
Working and being in the right place, so good things
happen. It's good news to all of us. It's good news. If you're willing, you can have the life of your dreams.
Now, let's go back a little bit before space now and talk about your naval career. You served in the Navy. You are a captain in the Navy, retired. But I believe you went into the reserves there when you were still in Fort Worth, and then on into flight school and those things. Talk about your naval career.
Yeah, ever since I was about 10 or 11, I wanted to be a pilot. Later on, I thought I wanted to be a Navy pilot because I heard they were better because they landed on aircraft carriers. That's not true, but as a high schooler, I didn't know that. It appealed to me, do you see? Yeah. I've got a consistent theme kind of going in my head. Yeah. And so I joined the Naval Air Reserve in Dallas and worked on airplanes, enlisted man, just did whatever I could to be around them. And when my mother, which changed my life in one day, mothers do this, she had told me, she said, they're going to give some tests for the NROTC scholarships. You could go to the University of Texas or somewhere else and get an aeronautical engineering. This would help you along. I said, Mom, they'll never take me. My grades are B's and C's. Who cares? And I was in bed the morning she came in and said, you need to get up and go take it. I said, they'll never pick me. She said, yeah, they will. So she got me out of bed, drove me down. I took the test, had the interview, and I think the thing they did, it wasn't my grades. It was the fact that I'd been in the Naval Air Reserve, and those people said, you know, this guy, he may not be the smartest guy around, but he cares about the Navy. He cares about flying. Let's send him to school. And that's what they did. Got my degree and went off to flight training. I did love flying. I didn't know that I would, really, because I'd never flown. And then I went to a squadron. I was aboard ship, and I thought it was fun. Every day I felt like I had the best job in the world. It was the best job for me. And I just loved it. And I looked around the ship, and in the squadron, you fly one airplane. We were flying an F-9, F-8 Cougar airplane, good airplane. But others, I wanted to fly them. And I heard if you become a test pilot, you could do that. And so I applied with my aeronautical engineering and the fact that I could fly airplanes good. Then they took me and trained me to be a test pilot. I got to fly them all, and I loved it. I had the best job in the world. Every day when I went to work, I just said, boy, this is great. They're paying me to do this.
But then you decided to become an astronaut, and you applied for that. Why did you decide to change?
Well, I one day I'm watching TV, and there's this guy, Al Shepard, on top of this rocket. I didn't know what astronauts did. I had no idea. I'm busy being a test pilot, which I loved. And I watched this guy in 15 minutes. I said, that guy has gone higher than I'd ever gone, faster than I've ever gone, and he's made more noise doing it. Maybe that'd be more fun than what I'm doing. So I began to set my sights on becoming an astronaut, although I didn't know where they came from. And there's where a lot of luck comes in. Like I said, I'm one of the luckiest guys you've ever met, anybody's ever met. I was in the pipeline. Al Shepard was a Navy test pilot 5 years ahead of me. John Glenn, the same way. Neil Armstrong, all those guys were test pilots ahead of me. And here I am in the pipeline to achieve my new dream. So I applied. By the way, I wasn't taken the first time.
And Pete Conrad had a role in that, I believe, in you and he teaming up again later on in that process.
He had been my instructor in test pilot school, and then later on he selected me to be on his Apollo 12 crew. He was a great leader. He was a natural astronaut. He was a natural, I've had so many astronauts come up to me and say, I wish I'd have had a chance to fly with Pete. Boy, you were lucky, Alan. You got a chance to fly with that guy. And I haven't heard him say that about many other astronauts. Mm. By the way, any.
Yeah.
He's the only one that they ever. He's different. To get trained with him, then when I flew on Skylab later and I was the commander, I tried to teach and treat my crew members the same way he taught me. Worked great. I didn't learn it before. I learned it from him.
So you and he had a close relationship, and you also developed that with Dick Gordon when you're training to fly in the Apollo mission. And then beyond those three, with the rest of the crew, the rest of the astronauts, do you still get together with those guys?
Yeah, we get together every couple of years. It's fun to see them, fun to talk with them. They're all off doing different things. Used to be when we'd get together at an event, you know, when we were astronauts, we were all talking about the new way to rendezvous, or whether we ought to use this particular piece of hardware, or that computer, which program, all that sort of thing. So we had a lot to talk about. Now we don't have so much. I'm sure when they get together, they say, what are you doing? Well, it's another painting. That's about ends the conversation almost. So it's nice to see what they're all doing, and they're spread all over the country. Good friends. We all care deeply about America. We all care deeply about the space program, and we still feel that way. I love being at NASA in the Navy. I was surrounded by patriots. I was surrounded by people that were willing to give their best effort for this country or for the space program. Mm. That's not everywhere, I've discovered.
Oh, no.
You're right. I've been blessed.
Unfortunately, you're quite accurate about that. Now, let's talk a little bit about that space suit you wore. You mentioned it a moment ago and all of the things that went with it in doubling your weight. One of the things I read that you said that you actually thought there, you're carrying some equipment across the moon, some radiating equipment, as I recall, and the heat's all there and everything, and you think, I hope the people who made this suit are as serious about their job as I am about mine.
That's true. We deployed the first nuclear generator on the moon, and it had a plutonium heat source that was about this long, and when I pulled it out of the cask, I had to have an adapter about this long. I couldn't get close to it because it heated so hot. These atomic energy is more than I imagined. I've read about it, but just seeing this little thing putting out all this heat, I put it in the generator, and as I carried it out, it was a long way from my leg, but it was so hot against the side of my suit. And I thought, I hope these little old ladies up in Dover, Delaware, that's where they made this suit, I hope they know that this is getting this hot because there's glue in there and stitches. Yeah. Like I said earlier, they cared. They made that suit where it didn't come apart. It
worked very well.
Yes.
Now, that suggests something here. Were you ever afraid? Were you, as we would say here in East Texas, were you scared on the moon?
In a way, you're always. I always feel it's one of the things you've learned about being a pilot and then a test pilot is you've been in dangerous situations and you've learned to sort of think during that period. It's still scary, but you've learned to somehow put it aside. That's a skill you've developed. At first, when you're a pilot, you can't do that, but you can learn. It's sort of like a quarterback. In high school, in the last 2 minutes of the game, if the game's on the line, he's probably not that great about throwing passes and all that other. But by the time he gets in college, in the pros, he's learned. And so we're looking at him on TV thinking, how can that guy even think? The game's on the line, it's the Super Bowl, he's doing great, he throws perfectly. He's learned. We had to do the same thing. The time that I remember being the most scared, I wasn't scared when the lightning hit. I was just surprised and didn't know what to do, kind of embarrassed myself. I looked out the window on the moon as we were getting ready to come into land. You're looking up for a while and you're using your velocity vector to slow down. Then when you get close to the surface, you pitch over and start operating like a helicopter. You're going very fast, but still. I can remember looking out and seeing all these craters, much more in the simulator, and I thought, there's no place for us to land. This is just too dense with craters. And I remember being scared. And I remember saying, I can't perform if I'm scared. And so I looked back in so that my peripheral vision wasn't looking out the window. And when I looked in, then it looked just like the simulator on Earth. And so I looked in, I did something with the computer, with the electrical system, I've forgotten. But something to kind of settle me down. I didn't want to miss the landing, obviously, but I still wanted to settle down.
Yeah.
So I looked out next time, and I was better. And so I looked in one more time, and then the last time I looked down, we were lower. We were starting to find some good places to land, and I wasn't scared anymore. Yeah. So it's scary. You're a long way from home. Your neck's out. You know that things could go wrong. You're not going to get back. Apollo 13 was the flight after ours. They were lucky to get back. But you've decided it's worth it, and you just hope that you're able to deal with whatever comes up. So here I am.
We're grateful that you did. Let's just real quickly here play a little word association kind of game. Considering your experiences as an astronaut, what was your greatest challenge?
Well, I think the greatest challenge as an astronaut or anybody in this audience is through their life staying positive, staying focused and happy about it. As I said, the first time I went for selection as an astronaut, I wasn't taken. And they didn't tell me why. I just said they didn't take me at this time. They didn't say, well, we'll give you a few more years to get better, or we wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole. They didn't say any. So I had a choice, whether I was going to keep trying to get more qualified or what, or go off and pout. I'd say I didn't want to anyway. Now, it's been the same way in my career. I was the last of our group of 14 to fly. Very discouraging to me. The bosses obviously didn't like me as much as they liked some of the other guys, all right? Because they were letting them fly and they weren't letting me fly. It's all competitive. So in their mind, I wasn't as good as those other guys. And I knew that, okay? I had to stay positive. I had to keep trying to do the best job I could do under those circumstances. I finally got my chance and did well. And after that, it was easy sailing because they could see I could do it. Mm-hmm. But that's been true through my whole life. Good things happen to people. That's great. Anybody can get through that. Bad things happen to everybody. That's the question. Can you stay positive? Can you keep working? Yeah. Can you do something worthwhile? Can you not go pout or look injured and still be good? We all have to learn that. We all have to learn. Some learn it better than others.
And quicker.
I was
okay,
slow.
Now, this is probably slow. Pretty close to the same question, but your greatest satisfaction?
I'd have to say similar along those lines. Mm-hmm. Like right now, I'm 79, okay? I'm not a young guy anymore, all right? But I still am doing the best I can every day. I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm here among students. I'm saying, if I can do my best every day, it's not as good as they can do. I don't have the energy. I have to take a nap. Mm. I have to, you know, I don't think as good. I don't remember as good. I probably couldn't pass some of the tests that I used to. I'm doing the best I can every day. If they will do the best they can every day, they'll have a great life. I've got a great life. But I've always said, or at least lately, life was meant to be hard. And if you can find a way to get through that and make it work for you, life is great. But you've got to do it. You've got to find a way to work through it. Life was meant to be a challenge so that it brings out the best of us. Mm. They'll find out. I mean, all of us know that, true. Yeah. There's many challenges out there.
You had some serious challenges, and you met them very, very well. I want to move on now to get to your second career, your painting career. And I think we've got some more pictures that we can look at here, some of the things you did. Now, there's the fantasy.
There's the fantasy, yeah.
Explain why that's a fantasy.
Well, there were really just three of us were on the mission. Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, Al Bean. Yep. Pete and I got to go to the moon. Dick Gordon had to take care of the command module in orbit 60 miles up. But when I left, I said, we need to bring Dick down to the moon. So here he is on the moon. If we look at the reflection in the visors, it's the TV camera. And so I'm imagining in this fantasy that people in mission control were saying, what's that guy doing down there? There's only supposed to be two guys on the moon. Who's taking care of the command module? And right behind him, that's me. I've got my glove fingers up, and I've got these little bunny ears behind his helmet. I'm saying, lighten up, mission control. This is just for fun.
Just for fun. And that is, I believe, your favorite painting.
It is. When Pete got killed, he got killed almost 11 years ago now, 8th of July, 11 years ago. I thought about the painting that I had done of him that I meant the most to me. And I'd done that as a commission to a company. And so I thought, I can't paint another one like that. And that's the one I want. So I went to them and paid a lot more money to get it back than they had paid to initially. But it was worth it. It's in my home in Houston. I look at it every day. I saw it this morning. Brings back a lot of good memories about a good team, a lucky bunch of guys that got to be the point of the spear for these 400,000 people wanting to go to the moon. It was great. Still is. I talk to Dick Gordon frequently. He lives in Sedona, Arizona. I don't know. We're good friends. We're getting old, though.
Well, when you have to depend on each other, I mean, you had to make sure when you got back up there, he was going to have the ship where you could get to it.
Absolutely.
So you bond with that kind of thing. Well, let's see some more of your work and the way you do it. Now, we're looking here at two people on the moon, and one's sort of running away, and one's got his arm stuck out this way. What's happening there?
Well, this was another kind of fantasy picture. Apollo 14 that went out two flights after us, Al Shepard hit the golf ball on the moon.
I remember.
Okay? I went to Pete, and I said, how come we didn't do that? That's fun to do. I mean, we were all businesslike. I mean, I can remember the first time I saw it, you know, in Mission Control, and Al hit it. I thought, well, why is he doing that? He should be picking up more rocks. That's our mentality. Later on, as the years pass, I realized that isn't. Humans aren't about all work. They're about play, too. And I asked Pete, I said, well, why didn't we think of somewhere? He says, well, we don't play golf. I said, well, I know, but there must have been something we could have done. He said, well, we like football. We could have taken a football. Well, we didn't. We didn't think of it. Okay, this is one called If We Could Do It All Over Again, Are You Ready for Some Football? And there's Pete, the quarterback. He's got the football. He's throwing it to me, and I'm running out there, and I'm going to catch it. So it's a fun idea. New astronauts, I meet them a lot. I'm out to the NASA area. They see these things. I'll bet you this. When they go back to the moon, they're going to take footballs. They're going to take soccers. They're going to take basketballs. When they go to Mars, they'll do it because they'll see these things and say, we can do that. We don't have to just pick up rocks all day long. We can have some fun, too.
Yeah. Okay, let's see what we have next here for our... Now, we're getting into the construction of the art here, and you've said that you're both an artist in two different fields in a way that you combine some sculpture as well as the painting itself. And so all of your recent, more recent paintings, at least, have these relief things that you do that. And part of them are the boots, the boot tracks.
Yes, the moon boots.
So how do you make those tracks in that?
Well, first of all, when I started painting, it took all my effort for months to get an image that looked beautiful, that was accurate. And it went that way for a number of years. And when I got where I could do it a little easier, I wanted to have texture in my painting because I've always liked it in other people's paintings over the years. Monet did some beautiful Rouen cathedrals with it. And so I began to use the tools that artists have used through the centuries to make texture. And then one day I said, why am I using these tools? These are earth tools. I've got moon tools. I've got moon boots. I've got the hammer I had on the moon. I've got a little Cortu bit. I could make texture that's appropriate for this stuff I'm doing because these paintings aren't like other paintings. These are the first paintings of another world by someone that actually went there. Mm-hmm. They're not earth paintings. They're off this earth paintings. And so I'd been just painting on regular canvas and things like that. I thought, you know, I could use some plywood that they make real airplanes out of, real wooden airplanes. Mm-hmm. So that's what I put down as a base. Then I put a texturing material called modeling paste there, put in moon boots, put in my hammer marks, things like that. Next slide will show us
let's
using
the hammer.
Now
at this point.
That's the hammer that...
really
that
on the moon.
That's the one I drove in the flagstaff with, the one I broke rocks with to bring home, things like that. I was supposed to leave it on the moon, and I got back in the limb, and I had it in my pocket. So when I got back to Earth, I handed it to the people at NASA. They said, what's this doing here? I said, well, I accidentally brought it in, and they kept it for a while, and then they said, you can have it. So I gave it to the Air and Space Museum in Washington. But then when I thought about this idea of texture, I wrote them and said, send it back. I'll give it to you later when I'm dead and gone. But right now, I want to use it. So they sent it back.
Okay.
And so I do that. And when you do these things, people help you. People help you when they see you're trying to do something worthy. I left a great job. Being an astronaut is a worthy job. But I said there's a lot of young men and women around here that can do this job. They're younger. They got better eyes, a better reflex. They can do it as good as I can or better. But I'm the only guy that walked off this earth that might want to celebrate that event with this way. It doesn't replace movies. It doesn't replace still photos or anything like that. It's just another way to celebrate a great human achievement. Let me show you the next slide here in a minute.
Let's see the next.
Oh, well, good question.
We're looking at now is some of the patches and things that were on your uniform. And how did you employ that in the paintings?
Well, what happened was I was wanting some moon dust to put in them. That would really make them special. I thought that'd be fun, but nobody ever gave us a moon rock. We kind of thought they would. Maybe they'd give us a little one for a ring or something.
Yeah.
But they all belong to America as a group.
Yeah.
So we understood, no problem. One day I was looking up at those patches there. Those were the ones they gave me from my suit. That's the American flag from here, NASA patch from here, Apollo 12 from here, name tag. And I was looking at them and I was thinking, boy, they're dirty. Those are dirty. And I was looking at my Skylab ones they gave me. They still give you your shuttle ones and all that. So I'm looking at my Skylab. It's nice and clean. I said, well, maybe I ought to have these cleaned. And then, wrong thought, by the way. Then I thought, you know, that's dirty from the moon dust on the ocean of storms. I've got moon dust. It's not much. But if I'm willing to cut those things up, those emblems up, and put them in my paintings will, in fact, have moon dust. So I do that now. By the way, the flag there is about two-thirds the length. The flag now on my wall is about a third the length.
Yeah.
So gradually, as time goes by, I put them in every painting. I put them where you can find them so someone would say, there's a piece of his flag. Yeah. Sometimes when I'm painting, like I did a painting not long ago of Neil Armstrong, and I took pieces of my flag and put them on the place on his shoulder where his flag was. So where his red stripe is, I have a piece of my red stripe.
Well, let's look at the little pieces there. Yeah, cut the patches up, and I think also you use some of the charred heat shield that came off in a crate.
I do. Down in the bottom there, you can see pieces of my patches. They're colored.
Yeah.
But our spacecraft, the Apollo 12 spacecraft, was sent to a museum up in Kansas. And it comes in a huge box. Spacecraft is bigger than a stage. And when they got there, it had been riding along in a truck, and a lot of the charred heat shield that had been charred off at 5,000 degrees as we entered, it kind of fell down on the bottom of the box, and they vacuumed it up. And the director said, you know, I'll send this to you, and you can put it in the painting. Now, that's the stuff there on the left edge of the thing. That's the dust from the heat shield of our command module. Later on, when I began using that, he said, there's some loose foil on the hatch between your command module and the limb, the one you went through to get to the limb and came back. We could send you a piece of that. That's a piece right there.
Okay.
I put pieces of that in there. So every painting has these boot prints, hammer prints, pieces of the charred heat shield, flags, moon dust. Why are they in there? Because I wanted to make the paintings as special as I could make it. I've never heard of another artist that put things like that in their paintings. It's okay. I remember NASA. Anytime you wanted to change something, you had to call big meetings, convince them it would save fuel or, you know, be safer. Here I just say, you know, that'd be more fun. I think I'll do that. So it's turned out to be more fun, and people like it. I like it.
And I think it's a great legacy, too.
It is.
Because
nice.
We're seeing now space we're seeing some of the same things, but we're seeing them through the eyes of one who was there and the way they're interpreted, and that's an important thing for us.
I believe it is. I often say, don't we wish Magellan had taken an artist along? We could see what happened. He got killed in the Philippines. Maybe they could recreate that. We could see a little bit more about what happened there. Same thing with Lewis and Clark. One of them was an artist, but he didn't do a painting of Sacagawea or any of these other things. We need more artists. Now, we don't need them as much now because we got movies, photos, TV, and all. But we do serve a purpose of trying to show and preserve great moments in history. This was a great thing that Americans did.
And the interpretation is what's important. Well, we're drawing near the end of our visit here, but I want to make a comment or two about footprints. You make them in paint. You made them a little while ago on the surface of the moon, and they're going to be there 40 million years at least. At least that's the best estimate. You're part of a very exclusive club, and number 4 out of 12 who have ever walked on the moon. One of the novels that I read a long time ago, I remembered a line in there It said, "Here is my butt, the very watermark of all my sails." I kind of share that a little bit, and I have great admiration for the things that you've done. And I want to ask you this kind of this one final question. Do you ever get tired of silly questions from people like me?
They're not silly questions. We need to keep this in mind because this was such a wonderful moment in human history and American history. We did this. Americans did this. We paid for it. We're the only kind. We're the greatest, in my opinion. These are everything I've said tonight is just my opinion. We're the greatest country that's ever been, and we need to keep this in mind. We're facing challenges now. But when I came to NASA in 63, going to the moon was an impossible dream, and 400,000 people said, "We can find a way." I wondered if we could. I'd never achieved an impossible dream. None of the guys around me or women around me had ever achieved an impossible dream. But we found a way. We've got challenges right now. Humans can do this. Americans can do this. We need to keep these good things we've done in mind and not keep in mind some of the mistakes we've made. We've all done that over the years. America's done that. We need to forget those a little bit, learn some from, but we need to keep in mind what we can do at our best. The space program was an achievement that Americans and humans did when they were at their best. And we can do those things. We can solve this money problem we've got. But we've got to be at our best to do it. We need to think about it. Young people need to realize they've got to be at their best. Yes. They can't think about the things we've done wrong.
We've
got to
do it as a
team. About what they can do.
Got to do it as a team.
We do. We can do it. We Americans can do it.
Well, let me say here then, virtually in conclusion, because we've got a little bit more to do. Gene Cernan, the last person on the moon, said just before the lunar landing module lifted him and Jack Schmidt from the Valley of Taurus, Littrow, for the rendezvous with Ron Evans aboard America, the last trip home in 1972, that's 39 years ago, he said, "We leave as we came, and God willing, we shall return with peace and hope for all mankind. Godspeed, the crew of Apollo 17. And to that I now add, and of Apollo 11, your own Apollo 12, anxiety-packed Apollo 13, and so on. As a child of the space age, from John Kennedy's pledge to Alan Shepard's Mercury 15-minute first, John Glenn's Earth orbit, and all the pathfinders of Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and Shuttle, particularly our own Columbia that's dear to Nacogdoches, and most especially to you, Alan Bean, Godspeed. Thank you for the life you've lived and for sharing a part of it with us this evening."
Thank you very much, Archie. Thank you, Nacogdoches. Thank you very much.
We have just one more thing to do, and it's my pleasure to bring President Petillo back up on the stage now for a special presentation.
Approximately 1 year ago on April the 10th, 2010, the SFA Board of Regents approved a new award. The name was to be the Lifetime Cultural Achievement Award. It's to be presented on an annual basis to a person of significance who comes to this campus and delivers a lecture, a talk, or engages in conversation here on our campus. It's also to go to a person who has played a major role in developing American culture and that has been impacted by the development of American culture. There is no question in anyone's mind that Alan Bean is worthy of this Lifetime Cultural Achievement Award. So at this time, on behalf of Stephen F. Austin State University, I would like to present to you the Lifetime Cultural Achievement Award. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our program. We hope to see you here 1 year from now when we will do the next special program of the Archie MacDonald Lecture Series. Good night.
The preceding program was recorded on April 14, 2011, by the radio television program at Stephen F. Austin State University in Nacogdoches, Texas.